Welcome to the Inspiring Social Entrepreneurs Podcast. My name is Fergal Byrne. Every week, I talk to inspiring social entrepreneurs and changemakers dedicated to building a better world. Here, they tell their stories, the highs and the lows, and share what they have learned to help other social entrepreneurs and changemakers on their journeys. I'm very pleased today to welcome Tim Freundlich to the podcast. Tim is head of Impact Assets, a non-profit financial services firm that focuses on improving the flow of capital into investments that deliver financial, social, and environmental returns. Tim is a long-time innovator in new financial instruments in the social enterprise sector. He worked previously at Calvert Foundation for 12 years, where he conceived of and launched the Donor Advise Fund. He was also instrumental in building the $250 million community investment note, with more than $1 billion invested in 300-plus non-profits and for-profits globally. Tim co-founded and serves as managing partner for Good Capital, that in addition to its flagship social enterprise expansion fund, founded the 2,500-person annual Social Capital Markets conferences in San Francisco and four impact hubs in the US. Thank you very much, Tim, for taking the time today to speak to the podcast.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Great. So I'm really looking forward to having an opportunity to talk to you about a lot of the work you've been doing in financial innovation around impact investment and social innovation. Can you maybe just to begin, just talk a little bit about maybe impact assets and what exactly you do?
Sure. Impact Assets is structured as a 501c3 public charity. So it's actually a nonprofit financial services firm. In the U.S., we have offices in New York, D.C., and San Francisco, which is where I'm located presently. And we do a number of things. The most obviously kind of scaled and the one with the most track record is we run a donor-advised fund, which is a platform for philanthropic endowment management, so assets that are earmarked for charitable distribution eventually, but have investment needs all along the way over time. We make that available in a sort of democratized solution that people all across the U.S. can access. And we have about 850 or so families and corporations who house their philanthropic endowment with us on one large asset management platform, which is about $400 million at the moment and growing at about $100 million a year, unless something happens one way or the other that to change that trajectory. And we do something pretty special, which is organize from the ground up across all asset classes, all different kinds of investment, time horizons and risk profiles, an impact investing set of solutions. So that was kind of the chief innovation of it, was to build a group platform that would allow all the money from day one, once it's endowed, once it's given, to be invested in social and environmental impact and positive entrepreneurship, etc. So that's what we have been doing for the last few years. This grew out of Calvert and Calvert Foundation in 2010, 2011, and has been scaling nicely. And that's the chief core program that we have. We also do some investment notes, which are available for direct private investment as opposed to within the philanthropic endowment land on sustainable agriculture and microfinance that we are testing out. And we have a pretty diversified portfolio in those two groups, doing mostly emerging markets investment of harvest finance for co-ops and small business and microfinance in the microfinance note. And then the final activity that we're up to is really, you could call it field building, but basically we maintain a set of collateral and commitments to growing the field and understanding it, making it sensible to people, not just people we work with, but the broader market. And we have an annually published database called the Impact Assets 50, which is up online and searchable at impactassets.org. And we publish that every year, and we kind of scan the whole landscape of investment managers in the private debt and equity impact space and put up nice templated, searchable data sets around them so that people can really kind of compare them and look at them. It's not due diligence per se. It's really an entree point for people to kind of demystify the landscape. And then we have, in addition, a whole set of issue briefs on particular areas of discernment, or, you know, sort of interest areas where we deep dive with co-authors and do these, what we hope are somewhat approachable, kind of plain English sorts of writings that are also available at our website, free of charge to all comers. So that's so the Donor Advised Fund, some impact investment strategies like notes, and then the field building. Sorry, that was a little long-winded, but that's the scope.
Yes, a very full plate there, Tim. And I'm keen and looking forward to talking to you about this platform and how it works. Now, just you mentioned the Impact Assets 50, and I guess it's a unique perspective on the impact investment world. What are, do you say, are a few of the key high-level figures here to note about, you know, people say, you hear various levels of excitement about impact investment, you know, that it's growing so fast and it's very exciting, and then others say but it's growing from a very small base. And what would you say are two or three key data points to kind of highlight what you think is happening or interesting about impact investment today?
And I think it's a fair critique too, to say, you know, it's like, it's one thing to say, oh, 20% year over year compound annual growth rates, and it's all very impressive in terms of assets, but the reality is it's easier to grow when you're starting small, but it actually isn't small anymore. And I think there is a bit of growth that is due to better counting of what's already been going on. And that is, in my opinion, a quite fair critique. But anyway you cut it, over $8 trillion of the U.S. investable asset base is in some form of social and environmental impact investing definition. And that's significant. I mean, this is more than 10% of all invested assets. Quite a bit more, in fact. There's about 70 trillion. So, you know, it's growing also at a good clip, and we're certainly seeing that climate concerns and opportunities and sort of poverty alleviation and economic opportunity, you know, economic development opportunities seem to be the two big lobes of interest and activity, and at least in, you know, from our vantage point in the U.S., there's also just a real quickening of the mainstream entry, and that's something that I think has really changed in the last 2 to 3 years in particular, and even in the last 12 months in the U.S., we've seen Bain and Company come out with $400 million. I just gave them an extra zero there.
Yes.
Or is it three zeros, actually? Yeah. $400 million private equity fund. You saw the Pacific Group TPG come out with the Rise Fund with a $2 billion, and that one is with a B, billion-dollar fund that a lot of celebrities and mainstream folks have participated in. So, you know, people are – it's really coming of scale, and I think – part of what's driving that is a recognition of a track record that is really validating the whole space for the mainstream. And whether it's the Domini investment, environmental social governance stock screens that have been beating and tracking the S&P 500 for the last 20 years to good effect, or generation investments. David Blood and Al Gore's investment group that I think is actually based out of London primarily, been in their offices there, that outperforms their benchmarks by like 500 basis points, 5% a year for the last decade. You know, there's real credible track record, and people are seeing tons of climate risk that needs to be mitigated and tons of opportunity on alternative energy and solar distributed energy systems. So that's the kind of stuff that's driving it. And those are the numbers that we're kind of wrestling with in the marketplace over here.
Great. Now, I spoke to David actually not long ago about the work that they're doing, and very, very interesting. And they're a very eye-popping kind of figures, aren't they? And it's quite a phenomenon. Now, I have a particular interest in the, I guess, the more social entrepreneur side of things, you know, at that smaller scale and size, and not necessarily, of course. And I'm just wondering, how much of that money do you think is would you say is traditional you know, looking for the kind of traditional returns which we've come to expect from, you know, financial in general, you know, VC or even private equity, but maybe just applied to a different sector or a different niche. And how much is actually getting into the hands of, I guess, what, you know, Harvey Koh talks about, you know, the pioneer, you know, helping social entrepreneurs over the pioneer gap. How much money is getting into the hands? How much concessionary finance would you say there is? And that you can talk about whether you think that's important or not, because I know there's a discussion about it's important that to have not just concessionary finance or you know that there's expectations about market related returns. But I guess the question there is, how much is getting into the hands of the pioneers, the smaller social entrepreneurs, the people taking the more risks, and is that important?
Yeah, I mean, personally, and from Impact Assets point of view, I think it is very important. We tend to be reflective of the appetites of, you know, almost 1,000 different answers to this question, that being those 850 plus clients and wealth managers that we're working with. So, you know, I don't in practice get very prescriptive about these kinds of questions in terms of our answer to it, because we have to be sort of innately pluralistic, if you will, just by the virtue of what we are as a platform, an intermediary for lots of different theses or thesi in this case. So, you know, on the one hand, that's my caveat, but then I'll just dive in and say that, I mean, we're seeing a ton of appetite in what I think is squarely that sort of activity that you're referencing. I mean, to put some numbers on it, we're doing 2 private debt or equity deals a week or more. And we're doing like 10 a month. And for clients that are specifically trying to reach those emergent social entrepreneurs, some of those are loans to nonprofits. Some of them are, you know, convertible notes into for-profits, but this is early seed stage and gap financing and early growth capital for social enterprises all over the US and in fact, all over the world. We're doing, I think we've already done 65 deals this year, and there's probably another 10 before year end. People love to get that last one in before Christmas, or at least before New Year's Eve. So, you know, it's we're seeing a ton of throughput, and our asset base is very unlike a Ford Foundation or a, you know, a Fidelity Charitable Gift Fund or even a Charity Aid Foundation over on your side of the pond, where we not only are we generally screening out the stock and bond, you know, malfeasance and looking for good practice and governance and diversity and supply chains in our stock and bonds activity and our sort of quote unquote more market rate activity, but we're arraying a whole range of private debt and equity options in addition to those direct deals that we're doing every week for clients, different private debt and equity venture funds. And I'd say, I mean, for about half of our asset base, close to it, it's about 40% of our asset base is very much directed in the ways I think that you're alluding to. And whether that's microfinance, whether that's the sustainable agriculture and the cooperatives and structures around the world that are doing that, affordable housing, or these direct ventures that are doing sustainable, really great, you know, strategies that are going after intractable problems and trying to meet them through innovation with economic upside. I mean, I don't think that it's very easy to create a bright line about what's concessionary and what's not in our clients' minds. I think they're being driven by their, you know, the good and the bad, you know, like trying to mitigate things that aren't working and trying to create opportunity, and are very much coming at it from a passionate point of view. Maybe that's because we're assets that have been first and foremost given away to eventually go to charity, you know, like a foundation's assets. But nonetheless, I think, you know, one person's gap-filling social purpose, you know, dressed-up philanthropy kind of investment that is definitely not a market rate investment from their point of view, somebody else might be saying, hey, you know, this looks like a great opportunity. serving the base of the pyramid and the 2 billion people living less than $4 at, you know, whatever segment it is. And I think we actually can do really pretty well while doing good. Not to mention, what does market rate mean anyway? I mean, you look at 2008 and, things that are supposedly so, blue chip and being run by algorithms, and then they blow up in your face and you lose 40% of your asset base in like 2 days, So it's like, I think our folks over here that we're dealing with in our client base are very much of a few minds on the question of even where the bright line is, much less particular deals falling into one or the other bucket. I know that that's a little bit of a meandering response, but it is sort of a nuanced question.
Yes, no, I guess there's as many different answers as you say as investors in one sense, and yet at the same time, I speak to many social entrepreneurs that find it difficult to raise capital, and I guess it's a little bit like in venture capital, you all hear this question: well, are there enough good deals out there, or is there enough capital, or is it what's the root of the issue? And I guess.
Just to cut in and be blunt for a second, when we put up a private equity fund on our platform for people to, allocate to at their interest, we do make an attempt to characterize it. So not only are we saying, here's its impact thesis, here's its time horizon and liquidity and features. We also do make a determination and say, this is sort of below market or near market or at market, because we think that's useful. I mean, a lot of it's about expectations. And so we are trying to kind of create some technical exactness around this, even if that's not that exact, but like at least bucketing stuff. It's just that then our clients come at it and they have their own point of view, regardless of what we say.
Absolutely, absolutely. So you do feel, I mean, your experience, as you say, is a reflection of the kinds of the structure of the fund you have and the expectations that maybe foundations have about this money in the first place. But more generally as well, you get a sense that there is serious momentum in the way investors are willing to trade off. And I know that's not always the case, and it's one of the more exciting areas of investment that sustainability actually generates very higher financial returns. But we're talking about the earlier stage. They're willing to say, well, this is impact led, and I am willing to actually say I'm modifying my expectations. I'm happier to I'm happy to have a lower set of expectations. As you say, these are difficult to pin down, but are willing to trade off for impact.
Right. Yes. I mean, I think there's a couple ways to go at it. I mean, one is people are saying, I'm willing to increase my expectations, because if you think about it, the whole spectrum as we're working with is from grant making.
Yes.
To quote unquote market rate investing. So if you come at it from the other direction, I mean, we're giving away $30 million a year. We did 6,500 grants to charities all over the world, mostly in the US, just last year or this year. So from that point of view, it's like, you tell me I can take people out of poverty and empower women with, financial inclusion and starting their own businesses and investing in their family's education in the developing world, and I can have a pretty stable, return on capital and get my money back and have basic liquidity in a microfinance pool. And I'm there right next to that. I'm giving away money where I get nothing back. Like, that's an above market, it's like, if you come at it from that way, that can be really exciting to people economically, in addition to the impact of those assets. So that's one thing. And the other thing is, people really are willing to take a haircut for value received. I mean, people are willing to pay more for the same basic functional element in consumer society all over the place. And all we have to do is look at our lives and luxury brands and things that we do with money that make zero sense. Like paying for a handbag with a label on it three times as much as the same thing functionally right next to it, or 10 times as much. Like, that's a form of trade-off that people are doing for some sort of psychic payoff. And And that's, you know, one way to look at it. We've also done tons of survey work in the sustainable brand context in the U.S., where they ask consumers, like, how much more will you pay for a socially responsible product if it looks like this, right next to the same commodity food product on the shelf? And there's a lot of different answers, but the magic number seems to be like 15%. People will pay 15% more for kind of a social wrap to something, as long as the quality is there. And I think it's highly variant, but obviously by consumer and product category and things like that. But there's lots of correlatives to this where people are willing to make trade-offs in kind of hard economic terms for soft value that really is not practical. And I think that although I don't hear people kind of drawing that comparison in that often, I think it's to my mind, intuitively a good one.
Well, that's very interesting. I just one last question that I mentioned. You mentioned this getting better returns, doing good. How does that work in the sense that, you know, traditional model of finance, risk and finance, you know, better returns, higher risk? How does it work that you can put money into a project which, you know, inherently must be riskier, hasn't maybe got a track record of even having a, you know, business models or having, you know, people talking about economic returns, that kind of thing, you know, moving into whole social areas, and yet generating, you know, the kind of returns or the kind of package that you mentioned at the beginning, which you know, you say are attractive to investors?
Say that you have to say that. Let's step off of that for a second.
I couldn't exactly summarize the what you were saying at the beginning about the microfinance bit, you know, that the people were interested in these packages where they were comparing to grants, they were comparing the ability to invest in financial instruments that were doing good, that were generating returns, that were, you know, all of these great qualities. And I'm just curious as to how that can arise in situations where, you know, which are challenging market conditions. Why is it not the case that these should be riskier and therefore, you know, more problematic? Do you get what I'm trying to get at there?
Sort of. I think the situation has to be assessed like in every subcategory and every, you know, every fund management structure and the thesis that they're trying to attack in terms of, you know, the impact in addition to the financial. And so it's really hard to have blanket statements around things that people, it's like what is impact investing return? Well, that's like saying, what is the investment market return?
Yes, absolutely.
Honestly, it's just a lens, right? Yes. And it's so variant. It's like, are we in subprime mortgages? Are you in, you know, big company stocks? Are you in, a treasury bill issued by the government with quote unquote zero risk? So, I mean, every situation is different. But I kind of organize things into two buckets. One is things that are gap driven primarily versus things that are opportunity driven. Primarily, that doesn't mean that opportunistic strategies that are aggressive can't also be, you know, filling in around some perceptual gaps in the market. But there seem to be sort of two driving primary motivations in the strategies and the, you know, the enterprises that we're financing. And it's this kind of like, is there this gap that somebody's trying to go in and fix first and foremost, and then figure out what opportunity and business models and economic sustainability and scale is there because of a passionate kind of practical need to gap fill, or is it more of a chasing an opportunity? And I think, sort of the clean tech movement might be an example of more of that. Whereas, initially microfinance might have been more of a gap strategy, although now you could sort of make the argument that it's growing up and becoming just a financial services opportunity, and it's kind of mainstreamed and there's plenty of players in there, et cetera.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. Very good. Now, I want to talk about this platform that you have. And you mentioned that it's a key part of what you do. And it's this one platform that allows different kinds of assets and so forth. Can you tell me a little bit about the rationale for developing this and what makes it a little bit different and why you think it's such an exciting idea?
Yeah, so the idea is everybody can be the Gates Foundation or the Ford Foundation. So in the States, you can set up an account with as little as $5,000 and actually get your own little personal foundation. Or it could be $5 million. I mean, and we have all along that spectrum, hundreds and hundreds of accounts. We even have some larger than million. I mean, we have tens of millions of dollars sized accounts. But basically, whatever the size that you then have access to a whole range of asset class buckets and different strategies. And some of them are pools that are diversified and already put together for you. Other ones you can pick a la carte, like, ooh, I want to do microfinance in the emerging markets, or I would like to invest in a specific company or type of company through a venture fund. And so we basically organized this both sets of prepackaged diversified pools that we arrange with our consultants and staff and investment committees, or also a la carte options that people can pick and choose. And there's not one or the other. You can use multiple of all of them. And it can evolve over time. So everybody suddenly has this like really deep impact investment capability that, you know, honestly, even these massive foundations don't have. And we get we give the scale of hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars and hundreds of clients all pooled together to facilitate that and create the kind of capability set at a professional level that people can organize their micro or their quite large asset base with us, which is eventually going to go not to buy them, you know, an electric car or that one of those handbags I was mentioning, but rather to you know, eventually go to charity or some you know, altruistic purpose. So it is a certain sort of money, and that's the context that we're dealing with. People are sending off thousands of grants a year out of this asset base, and we're funding all these charitable purposes. But in the interim and all along the way, all of the money has the ability to be flexibly and very customizably put into these kinds of buckets across private debt and equity and direct company and loans to nonprofits, investments in companies, and also those environmental and socially screened mutual fund sets or stock and bond sets. So that's, you know, that's kind of how it works. And what we do is we publish options up to it that come through our machine, you know, and we due diligence them and we, you know, look at this and that, and we talk about what's exciting and legitimate about it, and we put it up there, and people either will get exposure to a strategy because we've stuck it into one of those diversified pools, or if it's up on one of these a la carte menus, they can go, ah, I'd love to put, you know, X amount of money into that one. And so people are making those choices, and we're scaling, and there's more and more and more activity going on now that we're sort of a full-fledged out of our startup mode, obviously now pushing 6 years.
Right. Now, the Donor Advised Fund, can you just talk a little bit about how that actually works?
Yeah,
and
it's,
why it's such a good structure for impact investing? Yeah,
right. And this is like the Charity Aid Foundation in the UK.
Yeah.
A well-established kind of community foundation where it was structured originally and quite a long and back in the 1920s, I believe, 1930s in the U.S. is the first ones was set up in New York, and it is a way to allow, you know, the mass affluent of the country to be like the Rockefellers of the country. You know, it's a way to kind of democratize strategic family philanthropy over time without the number of zeros it particularly used to take to set up. Now technology enablements have been driven down for private family foundations, but private family foundations, even if you can do them relatively small. You've got to do tax returns and have tax preparers, and you can't be anonymous, and you don't, and you kind of are limited by your scale of what you can do. And whereas the donor advised fund allows people to bulk up and be part of something bigger than themselves, literally and figuratively, and really punch like a big private foundation in terms of capabilities and quality. And so there are hundreds of these set up in the US. The market is $85 billion. So smaller than the private foundation world at probably $700 billion, but it's growing really fast, 23% compound annual growth rate. In that case, it's the fastest growing vehicle, yes, because it started smaller, but it's sustained. I mean, it is big. And in fact, Fidelity, you're not supposed to name your competitors, but I'll do it. Fidelity's coming up on $20 billion, just one structure. We're coming up on $500 million. So we're like 1/40th the size of Fidelity. But, you know, we have designs on them. Small is beautiful, too. At yes. any rate, there's literally almost 300,000 of these individual accounts set up across all of those hundreds of donor advised funds, 850 of which are ours.
Right. Now, and when you're talking about the platform, what's different here, Tim, in terms of compared to maybe other ones? You said this flexibility. Is it something that gives when a donor is waiting or is made a decision, but not intending for this money to reach its ultimate destination for maybe 5 years or 7 years or something like that? Can you just talk a little bit through how that works?
Yeah, I mean, I could just give it as a use case. You know, let's say I've opened up a $25,000 or so account. That's on the smaller end of our average, but it's, you know, perfectly good example. And so I've gotten some windfall maybe from work or a sale of a small business, and suddenly I have for tax purposes, it would be a good year for me to give away a little chunk of money. So the person opens up a $25,000 account, and yet I have no idea actually where I'm going to give away this money. And I would like this to last me for a while, because maybe for me, relatively, that's quite a bit of philanthropy. Like, I've maybe been giving away a couple $1,000s a year, for example. And so whether or not I'm going to draw this out 10 years, maybe it's certainly going to last me a few years, and I probably want to think about what I'm going to do, because it's kind of a step function more than I've used in the past or done in the past. So that's the nice thing. I get my tax break today, like on December, 11th, 2017, right before the end of the year. I get to count it this year, and then it's sitting there. And so then I go to the platform and I go, okay, let's see. I probably am going to want to give away at least a few $1,000s every year over the next 5 years. And, but I also would like to take some time and maybe make a one large grant at the end of that, so I don't need any particular liquidity other than maybe 10% of it all along the way. And then I'd like it at the end. So then you sort of approach it just like with a family, you're planning your regular assets. You go, okay, so what should I do with the few $1,000s a year I need to be able to get at? So then I would go and look for a relatively liquid, low risk, stable pool that I could put some of the money in that was doing microfinance and community development, in our case, community development and sustainable agriculture, and find one of our options there that would give me a nice stable return, and that I'd be able to every year be able to take a couple $1,000s out of to make some grants to the stuff that I have been doing to sort of maintain that. But then maybe I'd also take a good chunk of it, say $10,000, and do something that's more illiquid, longer term, a little crazier on the end of the spectrum, something I'm passionate about, maybe technology for good, one of these venture funds that's doing early stage entrepreneurial venture investing, and know that I'm probably not going to see any liquidity on that for a number of years, but it's okay because I'm doing my regular grant making with my more liquid pool. And so that's, again, there's 850 answers to the example, but that's a perfectly reasonable one.
Yes. Well, it sounds very interesting that that this liquidity exists in these different kind of asset classes in the impact investment. Is this something relatively new?
No. I mean, only as new as microfinance and community development finance, which is measured in decades.
Yes.
But what has happened is it's been kind of professionalized and scaled so that there are not necessarily secondary markets, although in some cases in a limited way there are, but more just there's so many facilities out there that and different structures that people can ladder things and create pools that do have a lot more liquidity and match maturities or expected, you know, liquidity requests to stuff. If you think about it, you know, it's like if you go and buy a bunch of certificates of deposit, the first year you have to buy a 3, a 6, a 9, and a 12 month to have an option every 3 months coming due, right? Without a penalty. But as you grow through the year, by the end, if you keep buying them every 3 months, you can buy 1 year CDs, and then you'll still have an option every 3 months in the second year. So that's, you know, in some ways, that's a simplistic example of the kinds of things that go on as people start creating these really sophisticated, laddered pools that are providing debt into relatively mature, understandable markets with lots of absorptive capacity. And they're managing that so that when investors, although at any given point, you'd be like, how can that investor get that money out of those, you know, fair trade co-ops in the developing world growing honey and cocoa or whatever the heck they're doing? Yeah. In fact, it's not that complex. Like, you're organizing a really diversified pool with a diversified set of investors, and you're laddering things and having lots of different, you know, moments every month and every quarter where there is liquidity to do, and so that you can match it to investors' needs if they have it. And if they don't, you just continue on with your laddered strategy, and at scale and over time, that creates structures that are really, really accessible to a much wider integration into the day-to-day. And we've found, I mean, I think that the private debt market for impact is just, is, you know, maybe it's not as sexy as the venture capital, but in terms of impact and in terms of its functional integration into asset bases that really work and its risk profile, it's such a great tool for the world and for our clients to really reach very specific, credible impact strategies, but also to work with their day-to-day needs as an asset base.
Very interesting. Very interesting. You mentioned the ability for a small, mass affluent or just generally people to you know, as it were, act as a small kind of board foundation or so forth, you know, that idea that have their own little, fund. Now, I guess the foundations traditionally have been more grant oriented, although I know there's, you know, big changes going on there with the, you know, PRIs and MRIs and things related in that whole area. But to what extent, and I don't know, again, it's probably horses for courses, and there are many different answers, but the donors at the moment, to what extent are they, how much of this money would you say is generally intended for grants, and how much of it would you say is looking at a higher risk or looking at making returns?
Yeah, I mean, in the aggregate, we're giving away about 10% of our asset base every year. So that's one answer, is people have kind of a cadence in the aggregate of $1 out of $10 in this asset base per year. But, you know, over 10 years, they will give away whatever 100% of that asset base is on whatever point we're talking about it. Obviously, we're growing, so that is a little, you know, a little bit in constant motion. But then we have returns, and people are also adding more money every year too. So between the returns and on average in the market, across all the different kinds of things we're doing, which have been, are generally over time positive, and the fact that people are contributing more because this is a bit more of a checkbook for them, right? It's not just like one time thing, although that can be the case for certain folks. For a lot of folks, they're adding to it a bit when things happen on the year to year basis. And so that tends to match or even, increase the year-over-year asset base of even an existing clients at any given point of assessing it, because then we're also going out and finding new clients, which is growth separate from that. So, you know, on the one hand, people are giving away a hefty portion, but a small, you know, relatively small minority every year. But in the end, all of these assets have been donated, have been put to the public good, right? They've gotten their tax break. They set up their personal foundation, their donor advised fund with us at day one. And maybe there's another day, you know, a year later where they add to it, whatever. But regardless, it's all going to end up eventually going to grant making. They can't take it out to buy that electric car or or Gucci handbag. So they're gonna do it. But we are attracting an increasingly interesting set of folks, I will say, that are really, really turned on by this impact investing idea and this measurability and accountability and, you know, sustainability of these business models and entrepreneurial activities that are changing the world. And in that value proposition are finding a whole different kind of ongoing edification or purpose other than the grant making. I mean, so we do have clients that literally are setting up evergreen perpetual pools of investments for good that have not so much appetite for grant making, although they certainly do some. And again, that's not the norm, but that is definitely a use case amongst our 850, a subset of them, where they really are interested in more of an evergreen endowment for good that is invested and reinvested and reinvested over theoretically generations that may not be giving that much away to charity.
Right, right. And how significant are the millennials here?
They're significant. I mean, the, certainly that's where we're skating to, the puck that we are skating to is looking at the largest generational, you know, wealth transfer in history. $40-50 trillion in the next 20 years is going to get moved. And a lot of it's going to end up with millennials, and millennials, they get it. You know, they're much more integrated in terms of their values and consumerism and investments and jobs and social life than previous generations, according to, you know, the research that we've seen in our experience. And, you know, in terms of direct questioning of their interest and impact, there's sort of like a super majority of them will actually say, yeah, I get it. I want it. Generation X or the baby boomers, you ask them, you do not get those numbers, even after them being around it a lot longer.
Yes, yes.
But millennials, they get social entrepreneurship. They get purpose in business. 92% of millennials will say in one survey I read, you know, mainstream one, was believe that business and purpose should be this, you know, integrated, like that companies – should integrate purpose and values into that. It's not, I mean, why wouldn't you want that? But that's a really high number compared to previous generations. And it's indicative of where they want to work, who they want to buy from, and what they want to invest in, obviously.
Yes, very, very exciting. Now, John, I want to talk about your custom investments and give me some examples, talk a little bit about that, and maybe some examples of social enterprises you're supporting in this way.
Yeah, it's sort of like, where do you want to start? I mean, I'm looking at a list here of 65 just this year that we've done. I really like one story, Beyond Meat. It's a meat alternative, soy-based. How do you feed the next 2 billion people, right? Yes.
So what is a custom investment? Sorry, what is it in the first place? Just explain that maybe, yeah.
So a custom investment is an investment that's driven by one or more clients' interests as the motivation. And then we do our assessment of it, do the transaction and actually become the investor of record in the company. And so this is actually a referenceable client that initiated this request, which is the founder of Honest Tea, Seth Goldman, one of my favorite clients.
Interviewed Seth, yes.
Yeah, and he sees a lot of amazing entrepreneurs, as you might imagine, running around the world, being a brand ambassador for Honest Tea all these years, and building the company, which had a huge liquidity event where it sold to Coca-Cola over a couple of years. And he created a donor advised fund with us with his founder stock. Basically, he's a perfect example of somebody who's primary motivation, I would say, is the pursuit of paying it forward to the next entrepreneurs coming online. And so this was a young company that he got really excited about. And we did our work up on it. And we actually had some other clients, other donor advised funds on our platform participate at a couple of different levels over the years, last 3 years. And and they are in Whole Foods all across the U.S. and are Tyson Foods, a big publicly traded diversified ag company, food company in the United States, just led their last round with a $20 million investment. So they started off as a very early kind of startup, passion based entrepreneurial venture, but I'd say they're an example of an opportunity driven venture. I mean, they really see there. It doesn't take it might take a rocket scientist to come up with the mouthfeel of the burger alternative that's based on soy meat, whatever. But to see the opportunity of the population growth globally and the fact that meat is really, really tough to pencil economically at scale. It's very carbon and water intensive. It's very subsidized currently, and it doesn't scale as well as the world's population seems to be scaling. So at any rate, that's an example of one we were involved in this year again a follow-on investment, but we have invested in impact hubs around the United States, for example. And I know you have three of those in London, in Westminster and King's Cross, and also I think up near the Angel Tube Station, Islington.
Yes.
But this is an amazing social club meets co-working. It's you could call it the WeWork for the social entrepreneur set globally. Very bottom up, working across 30 countries, but it's very indigenously translated and locally owned. So each one, each city, or even each hub within a city across all of these, I think there's almost 100 of them open around the world now, are their own little ventures. Some of them are nonprofits and they take loans. Other ones are for profits, and we've had a number of clients sponsor or support through investment, loans, or equity their favorite city in the United States as an investment. And I think that's an example of, especially when it started, of being a gap. I mean, no one had heard of co-working. It was a new kind of idea. It wasn't really it was really about the need to connect people in a confusing, fragmented market so that they could change the world better together. I mean, that's why the Impact Hub, that we're better together. And so that was, I think, a great example of, of something that a lot of people in different markets have heard of.
Yes. And how did those, and then this is the Impact Assets team bring these ideas present these ideas to the donors? How does it work?
So custom investments work very client driven. So one or another or a set of clients will have something that they've run across or that they are passionate about, bring an idea to us and say, is this a viable structure? Can you look at it? And I'd like to, assuming it all looks okay, do some amount of money. And so that's very client directed or client recommended, if you will, in terms of the sourcing, although we do add value to it on top, of course. And then what we're trying to figure out, and honestly, this is a bit aspirational still, though we have done it anecdotally, is okay, well, when something has a lot of absorptive capacity and it's a credible opportunity that is being run by really cool social entrepreneurs, whether it's market rate or not is not my point, but that it is a highly credible, well-structured venture, even if it's an early stage one in some cases, in many cases, how do we invite others to participate along with that recommender? And so we're trying to figure out how to do that. We know how to do it. It's like, how do you do it without a lot of reputational risk and dragging people into deals that then blow up in your face? Because if you do enough of these deals on the edgy end of the spectrum, guess what happens? They do go out of business. And if they don't, you're doing something different than what you think you're doing. I mean, why should it be any easier to succeed as a social venture working in a gap in the market than it should be as a regular venture in a non-impact, kind of area? Because guess what? It's not easier. And those conventional ventures blow up every single year. You do 10 investments as a venture capitalist in the early stage, you might even not get one that's still alive. They need to do 20 or 30 to get a couple home runs. Yeah. And in our case, maybe home run is defined differently, but we see home runs too. Some of them are economic, some of them are impact, some of them are both. And so, you know, we do have a lot of, we take a lot of care in terms of how we invite people in, as opposed to our active fund platform, where we are looking all across the options at any given point and doing full diligence and publishing an a la carte fund, you know, a fund that's available a la carte, if you will, to our folks. Every quarter, we're putting a new private debt or equity impact fund up on the platform, or even two per quarter, I think, at our new run rate this, in 2018, it'll probably be more like that. And that we're widely publishing, we're holding briefing calls. And so there's some middle ground between those two extremes. And we're sort of developing capabilities and protocols to deal share in that middle space selectively, while still having an attention to quality control and reputational risk. So that's a lot to be written over the next couple of years, but that's where we're going.
Right.
For sure.
Yes. It sounds very interesting and I think very exciting area. Now, you've just published a new book. You're co-author of the Impact Assets Handbook of Investing. Now, why this book now and what is it about? I mean, I know what it's about. Can you talk a little bit about some of the key topics you're focused on
in
this?
You can get this on Amazon. It's actually published by Anthem Press over there in the UK. The why and the... and the now answer is, you know, there's a lot of demonstrated appetite. We've been talking about it. Everybody's reading about it. It's like everybody wants to do it. But the reality is not that many people are really doing it. Why? Because their financial advisors don't know their elbow from their nose on this stuff. Generally speaking, that's going to change, but it's going to change over years. And it certainly is not the case now where your average financial advisor is like up to speed on all the cool spectrum of things you can do to match your passion to world-changing attitudes to your asset base. And there's not a lot of available, accessible product in the client base of the world. So what the handbook really is doing is kind of approaching the how do you do this toolkit and making it actionable and really, you know, much to a much broader audience. That was kind of how we approached it. And we partnered with a lot of cool folks in the industry, practitioners, to write some, we hope, again, plain English sorts of chapters, co-authoring them. So I worked on a couple chapters and we edited the whole thing. Jed Emerson, who's a senior fellow with us, did a great job kind of pulling it all together. And we had some staff work on certain stuff. We also, though, brought in folks from the outside to put together, again, a kind of a toolkit of approaches. And so it's less about the why should you do this?
Yes. Yeah.
Intellectual argument, because I feel like that's been made.
Yes.
I mean, you can decide you don't care about it, fine, but you can't say there's not track record and there's not an intellectual approach to why you should integrate value and values into investment strategies across the whole spectrum. It's there, it's accessible. So we spent less time on that because that was last year, that was last decade, honestly, in my world, but and more about the how-to, because people really are ready and they're frustrated by the lack of clear actionability and the lack of clear advice they're getting from their financial advisors. And I will say, though, that one thing that really is changing in the U.S. at least, and I'm interested in how it is over there, is financial advisors and wealth advisor firms really are starting to not just like be interested and talk about getting it, you know, maybe starting to think about this. They're really starting to jump in because they're getting client they're getting clients walking out the door when they don't have an answer to this. And so, you know, we also had an eye towards that. We wanted to, you know, have something that was approachable for financial advisors and their clients to read and to feel like, oh, okay, I could do this, I could do that. So that was kind of what it's about. And it's coming, it seems to be very well received. We just published it last month.
Right. And it's for, it covers some of the ground for those new to impact investing, but presumably also, does it have information for experienced impact investors?
Yeah, some of the chapters go a little deeper and, you know, probably, you know, are a little more sophisticated in terms of their scope and depth. So there's something for everyone. But generally, I mean, we wanted it. The folks who are really deeply into this probably don't need the handbook, right? You know, they're doing it. They're writing the handbook every day. So it's meant for, you know, folks who are trying to get clear about a set of approaches, are probably at the more front end of their approach.
Right. What's on the mind now, Tim, of your clients regarding charitable giving? And I know there's a very big tax bill sitting somewhere in the Houses of Congress in the United States as we speak.
Well, there's a lot of uncertainty, and also people haven't even processed what they think might be the changes coming out of, much less the yes. fact that knows if they'll stick or what other changes, because they're gonna amend and try to fix this. Whenever you do something, this is all over the media, this fast,
yes,
the holes that you're gonna be able to drive trucks through are gonna be holes you can drive trucks through.
Yes.
So there's definitely gonna be a lot of there's a lot of uncertainty. I think I've run across clients who are telling us, oh, we're sending you some money because at least we know the situation today and we don't know what it's going to be on January 1st plus.
Yes.
So we'd rather get some more money in there now, lest things kind of turn into a fiasco. And or we expect our tax treatment or situation to probably change for the worse and make charitable giving less attractive. So there's a lot of uncertainty, a lot of agitation and concern, and I think it's accelerating, if anything, the move of assets to charitable purpose before year end in the U.S.
Right, that's interesting. Now, what's next for Impact Assets, Tim? Next few years, what's your aspirations?
Yeah, I alluded to it in that last set about the sort of how do these custom deals work? Creating a really fluid and thrilling environment. And capability sets that allows people to source and participate and share passionate, investments in a real-time basis, and to really understand the impact over time and to look at their portfolios, really developing that whole use case and the platform that supports it is front and center on our to-do list for the new year and 2019. The next kind of 24 months are going to be all about that at Impact Assets. And we're really excited about it. We're attracting clients who are really excited about it. And we're just responding. I mean, part of it is build what people don't know they want yet. I mean, yes, okay, we're a little bit of that, but we're also really in a unique place, I think, in the market in the US of having a critical mass of the Seth Goldmans of the world. All in one place, who want to do stuff, and they want to, in very different ways, share and discover other ideas, and share their ideas and discover new ideas. So, building that out, the really robust depth, fluidity of that, the thrillingness, and the thrill word I actually used technically, this concept of serve and delight in marketing that you may have heard of.
Yeah.
We're really taking that to heart. I think the last years we've been putting in a lot of hard knocks and track record buildings and justifying and apologetics on impact investing and social and environmental investing, trying to create a basic service level, a basic credibility. Well, you know what, folks, we're there again. I think that's a theme for this conversation. It's like that part, we can set that aside. We need to keep attention to quality of product and track record and activity and exactness, even across a whole spectrum of some things being market rate and some things not being market rate, and that's fine too. But setting that aside, let's make this a really thrilling, compelling experience, because that's what millennials want. That's what impact investors deserve. And we're gonna push on that delight factor. And that has some real technical, you got to build, that doesn't just happen accidentally. You really have to capacitize that and build and support that structurally and be innovative. And so we're going to move concertedly towards delight while we maintain our service level.
Well, fantastic, Tim. I wish you the very best success with all of this and a delightful few years ahead. And thank you so much for taking the time today to speak to me and talk about all the great work that you're doing, explain the fast-changing marketplace, the momentum around impact investment and the great work that you're doing.
Well, thanks a lot for having me.
Thank you for listening to the Inspiring Social Entrepreneur podcast. I hope you found this interview inspiring. Please make sure to visit www.inspiringsocialentrepreneurs.com and subscribe to make sure you don't miss any future podcasts.